Hello and welcome to another episode of Gemstone Mine. I'm John.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Jake.
And today we got a fun topic to talk about. We have a new set that's coming out. We have Kaldheim on its way. And if we're going to be doing a Norse mythology set, you better believe we're going to be seeing some cards inspired by Norse mythology, including the old gods of Norse myth. But before we get to talking about the new gods and some of the old gods and the whole idea of these god creatures in general throughout Magic's history, there's a little bit of news to talk about, not the least of which is what I just mentioned. Kaldheim is almost here.
It is. It more with every new release that comes and goes, the inability to go to a physical brick and mortar store and play or play in person is felt more acutely each time it goes on.
Yeah, so our local store is actually doing something kind of neat. This time, they're, in addition to selling their normal boxes for pre-release and everything, they're also offering a deal where you can instead buy pre-release kits at essentially a small discount to kind of make it more match what the cost of a box would be in terms of price per pack. So I'm going to walk out of there with 6 pre-release kits, and if other people can get pre-release kits too, that way we can still kind of enjoy some of the fun of pre-release just over webcam instead. So shout out again to our friends in Dungeon Games in Fort Myers in Florida. That's a pretty cool idea of you guys.
I might have to do that. I had a pre-order in for a box with them. I might just do the pre-release kits instead and try and resist opening them. And, you know, fun fact, since you're doing with the pre-release kits, you do have the additional foil slots for the promo. So technically, maybe get a bit more bang for the buck with them.
Yeah, that'd be pretty sweet. So apart from the gods, I guess why don't we take a quick minute? What other things look really exciting out of the set that you're excited to see come down the pipeline?
I'm going to say it to no one's surprise, elves.
Wait a second. Who are you and what have you done? Oh, you said elves. Okay, no, that's on brand for you. Jake, I think you've actually been inspired to like brew a new deck by some of the cool stuff that's coming out of the set.
Yeah, I started brewing one and then I wound up just sticking it in a different deck that I also kind of brewed, but it is one that we'll talk about later. So
awesome.
I'll
we're gonna
save it for then.
Yeah, we're going to hold you to that one.
For when we do our, we do, with the new set coming out, that means eventually we are going to have to do a set review on it and what's in our cart. But kind of not associated to the cards themselves, having just, you know, purchased a home and having walls to adorn. One thing that Wizards of the Coast does do is whenever they release cards, specifically sagas, they also release artwork and scroll work and banners of the artwork that appears on the scrolls. And I don't know if anyone's had a chance to actually look at them, but the artwork on all the sagas is absolutely gorgeous. So...
Yeah, I still really like the saga frame, like the layout for it and everything. I think it's a pretty cool take on your typical Magic card, and it gets the point across really well.
Yeah, it really does. And I have to say, it's almost like they, after 25 years of designing Magic cards, they really knew their way around frame layout by that point.
Yeah, but there's a lot of the saga work hopefully makes its way into the wall art and the banners and whatnot, because some of that's absolutely gorgeous and I wouldn't mind having it in the entryway to the house.
Yeah, that would actually look really good. I finally got to go see the new Alex house and that would look really sweet right there in the entryway.
Yeah, and recently spoiled, the Raven's Warning it's just the Azorius saga, but the artwork on it is absolutely gorgeous. If you haven't had a chance to look, that you should. But it looks great. Same with Ascent of the Worthy, is the black white, the Orzhov saga artwork on it is also fantastic.
Awesome. It's gonna take a lot to take the place of my Necropotence and Mana Drain prints in my office.
Well, I don't have to share my house with anybody else. I could have them everywhere.
As I look around my office and I've got a sign in blood hanging over my piece of furniture that I store my Magic cards in and the War of the Spark poster directly behind my head.
If any of our listeners know a place where you can get good framework done on playmats, that would be awesome. Just leave it in the comments, because if you had a chance to go in 2019 to any of the Magic Fests, they gave out Lightning Bolt playmats. And depending on when you went, it's actually the top or bottom of the Lightning Bolt art. So I've been wanting to get it framed, the top and bottom halves, and then put on the wall somewhere. But I have no idea where to start looking for someone to frame playmats. So if anyone knows that, let us know. Sorry, I thought I would just advertise since I'm trying to decorate the house.
Oh, this is, see, Alex, this is an important part of how we grow as a podcast. It's called audience engagement. And what you did there, that was textbook excellent audience engagement. We are professional, semi-professional, amateur podcasters.
Also, please like and subscribe and share with your friends.
And ring the bell. Don't forget, ring the bell.
That, yeah. Check out our OnlyFans.
speaking of semi-professionals, though, I do want to give a shout-out. I have been watching some more long-form CDH gameplay videos recently from a group called the Mind Sculptors. So the Mind Sculptors are kind of like a CDH supergroup. It is Callahan, Phoenix, Cobblepot, Pongo, and then they have a lot of recurring guests. Like most recently, they had the gameplay series you really enjoy, host from Play to Win. They had them on, and these are just really knowledgeable people who do put out a regular audio podcast, but they also intersperse that with gameplay videos every week or every other week. Their long form gameplay videos, which is committing 2 hours to watching gameplay videos, is kind of rough. But they make it worth it by, over the gameplay video, they have commentary and color commentary with two people who are very knowledgeable about the format talking about what's going on. You know, like, well, based on their opening hands, I'm going to guess that Pongo is going to try to go for this with the tutor. And I would have played this land first because that opens up this line for turn two and turn three. And it really lets you get in the heads of people who know these decks really, really well. And if you're looking for a good gameplay video series to watch, they've only got 5 videos out so far, but all 5 of them have been really good. So that again is the Mind Sculptors, just like Jace, just plural.
I like long form videos, so that's a bit of my alley. And it's kind of a segue here, Jake. You had mentioned subscribe to our OnlyFans. For Magic, how about we just call it Only Lands?
Yikes.
Yep.
Just Only yikes.
Onlylands.com.
Just yikes. Alex, I don't know what we would do without you, man. I really don't.
Probably more productive. That's realistic. plus tangents.
If there's no other real news for us to get through as we're still waiting for Kaldheim to come out, let's talk about some games we've played. Alex, have you been jamming away any Historic Brawl games?
For the very short time that Historic Brawl was available, I was enjoying it, playing a historic version of Korvold, a historic version of Rise, and those were fun. I honestly think that they should leave Historic Brawl around longer for when they inevitably just introduce the entire Magic catalog into Arena, take Magic the Gathering Online out back and shoot it, and then I can play Commander on a, you know, OS or platform that actually looks and can handle it and isn't, you know, Magic Online.
I'm sure there are quite a few people who have just started crying openly at the thought of Magic Online being taken out back and shot.
It is weird because there is currency involved in it. So, like, that's the one downside. Like, there's monetary value behind it. But it's fun playing Rise on Arena is interesting. Just watching, you know, degenerate things happen with Scoot Swarm and, you know, Rise shenanigans. It's fun. Like, I'm a degenerate token player. I have no shame in that.
Speaking of degenerate, I got to have a very degenerate win last week playing in a CDH pod. Again, with the shout out to the goons. We had a game where I was playing my Yuriko deck, and that is a blue-black deck. And I won with Dockside Extortionist.
That sounds reasonable and fair.
So there exists a card called Sakashima's Student. Sakashima's Student has ninjutsu for 1 and a blue. And just like Sakashima, the original Sakashima, the new Sakashima, and any other number of clones, its ability is that it comes into play as a copy of another target creature. Well, somebody else had played a Dockside Extortionist out for value. There were enough artifacts and enchantments on the field that I could cast Sakashima Student for 1 and a blue. Well, not even cast, just ninjutsu it out for 1 and a blue. Then I got my 5 treasures. Then I cracked 2 of those treasures to ninjutsu out Yuriko. Then I could replace it by ninjutsuing out Sakashima Student, netting 1 treasure for each loop, and thus generating an unbounded number of treasures. From there, it was kind of trivial to just win through whatever the other people were trying to do.
Well, that's gross.
It's the only deck in CDH that gets to play Sakishima Student for pretty much exactly that reason. And yeah, if everyone's playing Dockside Extortionist, I'm going to play Sakishima Student and have fun.
The other side of it's like, I make tokens, go burr. Yeah.
I made tokens too. I made an unbounded number of tokens. I just didn't need a way to turn to do something with them.
So what you need is when we can actually play in person again, you just need to buy like a copious amount of treasure tokens. So when you do that, you can just like dump over the deck box and just have tons of tokens everywhere. It's like, see this? I'm reveling in riches, pun intended. I win the game now.
Well, in our most recent episode, our mini episode last week, we talked about some Scrooge McDuckian vaults full of treasure and some answers to them. And as long as we're being amateur, professional, semi-professional podcasters, you should check that video out from our Hidden Gem series.
And on that note, gods.
Oh, my gods. So today, our goal is to kind of go through the entire history of gods in Magic. How these creatures first appeared, how they were iterated upon, which versions of them we've enjoyed, which versions of them have made an impact in the game as a whole. Now, Jake, I have to first of all say thank you. Number one, you accidentally gave us the idea for this whole episode when I asked you for an idea for an episode, and you were busy playing Hades on your Switch, and you just said, I don't know, gods? And I said, yes, that's perfect, let's do it.
Yep, that's pretty much how that happened.
Then, I will also say, Jake also knew the proper Boolean and commands for Scryfall to be able to get all the gods sorted in a nice list based on the date they were printed.
That's fancy.
It is very fancy, and it's going to make our jobs so much easier today. So the first time we actually got to see a glimpse at gods, which, unsurprisingly, in the first time we went to Theros. Theros being a Greek mythology-inspired set, Mark Rosewater has been pretty open that the way they had built that set was based on a book that he got out of the children's section of the library about Greek mythology, which was titled subtitled something like Gods, Heroes, and Monsters. And out of that, in the first Theros set, we got a cycle of five gods. Unsurprisingly, they mirrored the basic color pie in Magic, with a white god, a blue god, a black god, a red god, and a green god. So we got Heliod, Thassa, Erebos, Purphoros, and Nylea. Alex, why don't you tell us a little bit about the design of these gods and what made them so unique initially?
Just want to throw a quick disclaimer out there. This podcast and what we discuss is traditionally aimed towards Commander, EDH, or occasionally Brawl because I'm a degenerate and enjoy it. That being said, the views here are based off of a Commander perspective. There are some gods that were fantastic in Modern or in Standard when they appeared there, but carry over less. So any of you say, hey, this god is relatively weak, know that it's coming from a Commander perspective and not a other format perspective. Looking at you, Thassa.
And Hazoret.
And Hazoret. Alright, so Theros brought us the original monocolored gods. So we have normal color pie, and each one of them has an effect that, for the most part, ties into them. The two biggest and distinctive, or technically three distinctive things about them are, one, they're indestructible. Nothing new, nothing fancy there. They are enchantment creatures, once again, not something remarkable in and of themselves.
That was an entire theme in that set, these enchantment creatures. Things that were both of the gods and of the mortal plane, too. So both creatures and enchantments.
And the keystone aspect of these gods is something called devotion, which appears not only on them, but through the rest of them. And devotion reads on all the cards, as long as your devotion to blue is less than 5, enter god name, is not a creature, it's only an enchantment. So in order for these gods to come out of Nyx into the land of the living, there had to be enough devotion or color to them present to bring them into the mortal world. So on the mono-colored commanders, it's a devotion of 5, which means that you had to have a grand total of 5 white pips, 5 blue pips, black, red, or green pips in order for this god to no longer simply be only an enchantment, but also a creature as well, and come into the world of the living.
So, Jake, how did we see this initially make an impact in Commander? You had a really good point when we talked a little bit about Theros Beyond Death and the stickiness of those gods that we saw in that set. How did these initial crop of gods start to make an impact in the format?
Well, in Commander at the time, you definitely needed to play a little bit more exile effects or something that can deal with the fact that they are indestructible. I think this was back when the Tuck rule was still in effect. I actually can't remember, but
I'm gonna take a look at that. Just go ahead. I'm gonna take a look while we're doing that.
I want to say that was used as an answer because their
I know
indestructibility
Ravel
was
into Aether was
kind of
printed in the
obnoxious.
same set, and that was considered a pretty powerful effect.
Chaos Warp was a that was a common one in my playgroup at the time, where they got when Theros came out. It's like, oh, warp away a commander.
Yeah, you needed some way to answer an indestructible enchantment, which is not super common. Once they turned on, they were a little more vulnerable, but before that, you would have to either just accept that they were there, or find some fairly narrow way of getting rid of an indestructible enchantment.
Okay, so the rule was changed in the spring of 2015. It's like March 23rd, 2015
Okay,
is
yeah.
when they changed that.
And the original gods were 13.
And you saw effects like O-ring become more popular, getting rid of them. And you know, one of the answers to them actually came from Theros itself in Banishing Light, which answers the gods.
Right, which is an Oblivion Ring type effect.
Now, of the original gods, as far as Commander is concerned, the largest impact, and pun intended with this one, is Purphoros, God of the Forge.
Oh, absolutely. So Purphoros, God of the Forge, is 3 and a red for a legendary enchantment creature god. It's a 6/5 with indestructible. As long as your devotion to red is less than 5, Purphoros isn't a creature. Whenever another creature enters the battlefield under your control, Purphoros deals 2 damage to each opponent. And then on top of that, he's basically got throwaway activated ability, 2 and a red, creatures you control get +1/+0 to end of turn. That by itself is extremely powerful, but just so overwhelmingly overshadowed by that first triggered ability on Purphoros.
Does Purphoros ever need to be a creature? Nope.
In
It
fact,
it's good as it is.
you're probably safer if it's not a creature, just because it opens it up to less removal.
Definitely. And that's honestly where it sees play. I mean, in my old play group, as soon as Purphoros was released and spoiled, Hayes, one of our content creators and friends of mine from back home, had a Krenko deck where a Purphoros resolves. It's like, great, I'm going to get shotgunned in the face by a million goblins here. And you know what? I mean, it's like Jake said, it's an indestructible permanent. Like, there is only at the time a finite number of ways to handle this. Did a Purphoros resolve? Great, you're more than likely going to die the next turn. And then, aside from Purphoros, and the second most impactful one is in terms of value as well, is Erebos, God of the Dead. And since it's a black card, Jake, you can tell us about that one.
Basically a greed effect, which is like a bad Necropotence. But
Tell us how
it
you
does
really
have
feel.
some usually trinket text of your opponents can't gain life. That doesn't often come up, but when it does, it can be kind of handy.
And then its main effect is 1 and a black, pay 2 life, draw a card.
And then just goes downhill from there.
Yeah.
And like all the other gods, it's fairly under-costed for its stats. So a 4 mana for a 5/7, but that's because you have to do a little
Little
jumping through
legwork.
hoops to turn them on. Yeah.
And it's worth saying, like, so Nylea, God of the Hunt, is, and it's the green god, so I mean, of course I'll take that one because it's near and dear to me. It's probably the most underwhelming in terms of the god, but I think that's the trade-off for also it probably being the easiest one to get devotion to, seeing as all the mana dorks that exist in Magic are predominantly green. It's 4 mana, 3 generic and a green for legendary enchantment creature god. It's a 6/6 with devotion 5. Its effects are all the creatures you can control get trample, and 3 generic and a green creatures you control get +2/+2 until end of turn. So a slightly less good overrun. The trade-off there is that you could, in theory, have an active god turn 2, turn 3, depending on, you know, how good your starting hands were. Its long-term effects just aren't as good.
Right. And then I actually built a Thassa God of the Sea deck way back in the day, and she was the 2 and a blue for a 5/5 legendary enchantment creature god, indestructible, devotion to blue, 5, blah, blah, blah. At the beginning of your upkeep, scry 1, and 1 and a blue target creature you control can't be blocked this turn. So it just wound up being a kind of fair to middling value piece that also allowed me to just start chipping in with creatures early game. This was before I think I really figured Commander out very well, but it was still a fun deck while it lasted.
And then last, we have Heliod, who really only wins at having the best art of the 5 original gods. It's worth noting, he falls in second to last or last place of the original Theros gods. That being said, when we eventually get on to Theros Beyond Death, he comes back with a bit of a vengeance.
Right, so Heliod, God of the Sun, is 3 and a white for a 5/6 legendary creature god with indestructible, as long as your devotion, blah blah blah, 5. Other creatures you control have vigilance, which is a nice but kind of overranked, overvalued keyword in Commander.
The market is oversaturated with vigilance effects.
Yeah, and then its ability is 2 white-white, make a 2/1 white cleric enchantment creature token with. It's fine, just until recently, clerics weren't really very relevant as a creature type. The cost for it was fairly expensive, and the fact that it was an enchantment is mostly all downside in mono white, but yeah, exactly. It was the least impressive among them. Now, Alex, before we get on to the other cycles of gods that came later in the block, in, for example, the Born of the Gods, we saw the first allied color commander color pairs. And then in the second set, Journey into Nyx, we saw the enemy color pairs. You have described that you did not feel like these gods, this entire Theros design, was something that really spoke to, as you called it, the fantasy of what gods should be.
So, and this harkens back to my peasant tribal roots. It's like you've got gods, and for the most part, these gods have denizens of whatever realm they live on that worship them to bring them out of Nyx, out of, imagination into reality. The problem with devotion, or pretty much any of these gods in general, is it cares more about just a color pip in the card itself, and not anything specific. So, when we were getting ready to record this podcast, a comment I made was great. I can have a whole bunch of, glass caskets, which is just a throwaway enchantment removal card that's in standard right now. But with enough of them, Heliod can, cease being a myth and become reality here in the world. And that doesn't, to the fantasy doesn't strike to me. It's like, cool. If I play enough, banishing or, O-rings and Banishing Lights and the whole bunch of generic, just one pip white enchantments, my god is now active. There's no fantasy in that. That's not to say it's not a cool mechanic and it's not powerful, but the fantasy aspect of it isn't there. And there's more that it could. Now, with the allied colored pairs, there's a bit more in terms of, hey, there are some cards printed that kind of show worship to them. More specifically, Mogus and Iroas, and that's just because, hey, there's red. Okay, you've got gods that care about attacking. That's what red does. Fantastic. But there just doesn't have the same pizzazz or storytelling element in game or card-wise that some of the gods later on this list rectify.
So I guess the question then is, if you had been in charge, what would you have changed about devotion to be the thing that, what would be the trigger then to manifest these gods? I'm going to put you on the spot here.
So it could be based off of, so if you say it's color pips, but instead of it being all color pips, it has to be color pips on creature cards and or creatures of X type that fit into whatever this is. So for Iroas, it would be a, I use
Well,
Iroas as an example.
let's stick with the
The
five gods we
original
talked
five.
about so far.
So, okay, so with Theros, or with Heliod, it would need to be 5 white pips, or 4 white pips, because Heliod being, the gods being arrogant in and of themselves, count themselves as that. So you would need 4 pips that come from creature cards, and or 4 different kinds of, like, clerics and or soldiers as well, because those are the gods, or the denizens, or beings of Theros that normally pray to Heliod. So if
Okay.
you could say, hey, whichever you hit first. So you either have 5 white pips or you have 4 clerics and or soldiers, and that ticks it. So that, say for example, you're playing a multicolored deck where, you're not just mono white, where you just don't get it after having a whole bunch of enchantments on the field, but you're running, clerics and soldiers and all that. Well, these are the denizens of Theros that pray to Heliod. So enough of his followers in place can bring him in, as compared to just, here's a Cathar's Crusade, well, I'm halfway to devotion, kind of thing.
Okay. Jake, what do you think? How do you feel about this implementation of bringing the gods to life?
I think it's good the way it currently is, because it's the first take on gods. It's pretty much showing that these are the gods of each color. So we have, you know, the white god, the blue god, black god, whatever. We don't have the merfolk god and the cleric god. I don't know. I don't think there's anything wrong with the current design.
Yeah, and so I like this design. It's probably my favorite representation of gods starting out as these ethereal, not really real beings, just myths that shape the world around them. And then once the world is close enough to their liking, once it matches their colors, then they can start to come into play. The devotion mechanic at representing them coming down from on high and actually joining the fray, that did speak to me. Particularly because it also fit in well with the other mechanics of the set, where this was an enchantment-focused block that you would have lots of colored pips sitting around on the battlefield. There weren't a lot of colorless things that were going on here. As a result, it was a pretty good way to say that, yeah, early game, you may not... Heliod may just be an ideal somewhere out there in Nyx, but after a few turns of more of the color of white manifesting itself more and more in play... that devotion reached a high enough level that Heliod actually came down from on high to join the fight on your side. To me, that transition between myth and then reality really fit that, for me, fantasy of what the Greek gods were. They came down from Olympus and meddled with mortal affairs once things were to their liking. And I think, Alex, to your point about the idea that tribes supporting these gods... I think it's a really interesting idea, but I don't think it was right for Theros, just because if Theros was also going to then be a tribal set in addition to a enchantment set, that probably would have stretched the design space a little bit more than would have been truly feasible. That said, maybe that's something in the future that we see where we do have gods of goblins and gods of merfolk and gods of elves coming down from on high once your devotion to elf equals 6.
I mean, you say that, you know, Thassa is not a merfolk god. I mean, if you look at the Thassa, she's clearly a merfolk.
Understood, but there also wasn't very much of a merfolk theme in...
And this is more just about feel and the fantasy of it, not so much of whether the mechanic would or would not work. It's just more...
Yeah, I'm speaking to it from more of the design standpoint. But I think that is a really... That is such a cool potential future design space the next time we do some kind of a... But we're no spoilers quite yet, but in a tribal set, that's something that could come out in a really interesting way. But why don't we talk then about any of the gods who came from the Born of the Gods set? That's the next one. We have the allied color pairs. So we have white-blue, Afara, god of the polis. We have green-white, Karametra, god of harvests. We have black-red, Mogus, god of slaughter. We have blue-black, Phoenix, god of deception. And we have red-green, Xenagos, god of revels. I'm going to throw it over to Jake for this part, because I know for a fact that multiple times you have built one of these.
So first I'm going to talk about Phoenix, god of deception. I've never actually built this, but I do like blue and black, and I am constantly annoyed at how it is always pegged as being the milling combination whenever they try to think of a mechanic for it. So just seeing that made me kind of sigh a little bit when I saw the spoilers initially. I believe you're talking about the various Xenagos decks I have built in the
I am, in fact, talking about Xenagos.
Yep, so that was, I guess, probably one of my first forays in trying to actually, probably not even competitive, but just trying to optimize a deck as best I could, and I certainly tried with Xenagos, and I feel like I got it about as far as that deck can go.
Let me read you in then with Xenagos. So Xenagos, god of revels, is 3, a red, and a green for a 6/5 legendary enchantment creature god with indestructible. This being a 2-color god, the devotion count has to be equal to 7 in order to activate Xenagos. At the beginning of combat on your turn, another target creature you control gets +X/+X until end of turn, and it gains haste. X is equal to that creature's power.
It was not uncommon with Xenagos decks to just completely just get someone out of the game in one turn.
Even if it wasn't one turn, it was very, very frequent that it was, okay, I'm sitting here, I'm sitting pretty, I'm at 39 life, I've cracked a fetch land, things are, oh my god, I'm at 12. What actually just happened? Oh, Xenagos just made a very angry dragon even bigger and angrier.
I want to say, out of all the sets, Theros, Born of the Gods, Journey to Nyx, the most commander playable versions of gods probably came out Born of the Gods, because we've seen plenty of Phoenix mill decks running around, Xenagos decks running around. I myself, the one out of these five spent the most time with, was Karametra, God of the Harvest, which is 3 generic, a green and a white, legendary creature, enchantment creature god, indestructible. Her devotion is 7. And whenever you cast a creature spell, you may search your library for a forest or plains card, put it in the battlefield tap, and then shuffle your library. So this was hearkening to Alex likes to play things that get lands and puts them in the play and they do things.
Also, a really common home in the Commander metagame in general for green-white Enchantress decks, when your commander could then trigger your Enchantresses and get you those extra card draws and just incidentally provide the ramp that the deck probably wanted anyway. This was not an uncommon build path for Karametra.
And I've even come across some decent Ifara builds, God of the Polis, 2, a white and a blue, indestructible, legend, enchantment to god, devotion 7. Beginning of each upkeep, if you had another creature enter the battlefield under your control this turn, draw a card. So I saw a lot of cool stuff with blink effects with Ifara.
I saw a lot of flash decks built around this, where they were playing things like White Mane Lion, just trying to play dinky creatures and get those card draw triggers going. And the issue was always that I saw, just trying to find a way to actually put it all together into a meaningful package, seemed to be the only real limiter there. But yeah, I've seen lots of Ifara decks.
And then there's Mogis. I mean, it's Minotaur's go brr.
Usually, I've seen this one mostly as just like that classic Punisher deck. So it's Mogis, God of Slaughter, is 2, a black and a red for 7/5 legendary enchantment creature. God with indestructible, devotion count has to be 7 for him to be a creature. And at the beginning of each opponent's upkeep, Mogis deals 2 damage to that player unless he or she sacrifices a creature. So either he is going to be cutting down your opponent's creatures for you or just punching them in the face. And the version of this deck that I've seen most frequently is definitely just Punishment Tribal.
So I had a buddy in North Carolina, Kyle, and he had a Zozu the Punisher deck. And the amount of times I saw him take Zozu apart, go to Mogis, get a couple of games, and the next week he comes back and Zozu's back together. There was something there where he thought every set that came out Mogis, it might be the time for it to shine. And then it always ended up going back to Zozu.
Jake, any other final takeaway thoughts from our Born of the Gods before we get on to the journey into next ones? I think we can safely say that these have had their fair share of an impact on the Commander metagame as a whole.
Yep, I remember them all being popular during their time.
All right, so why don't we get then on to our journey into Nyx gods. So these five gods were the ones who represented the enemy color pairs. So Athreos, God of Passage, is white and black. Iroas, God of Victory, is 2 red-white. Keranos, God of Storms, is blue and red. And Krufix, God of Horizons, is green and blue. Then there's that other one, Fyrica, God of Affliction, is green-black. And being somebody who really enjoys Golgari and the graveyard, why don't I start talking about Fyrica and how sad I am at the poor Golgari goddess. So Fyrica, God of Affliction, is 1, a black, and a green for a 5/5 indestructible. Devotion has to be 7 for her to be a creature. And her activated ability reads, black, green, exile target creature card from a graveyard. Its owner puts a 1/1 black and green snake enchantment creature token with death touch onto the battlefield. I have tried so many different times in so many different ways to make this deck actually work.
I want to say that Journey into Nyx is the home of the gods in the 99 that almost make it, but never quite do.
I think there are a few exceptions among that, but I agree that at this point, these gods were a little bit less, I think, inspiring might be the right word to use.
Well, I mean, yeah, in a commander perspective, yeah, the only one that really kind of shook things up a bit, or the only two I would say would be Athreos, God of Passage, and Krufix, God of Horizons, were the two interesting ones. And
I think Athreos's biggest impact was making Shadowborn Apostles expensive.
Yes, do we really need to shout out the command zone? Athreos, I did have an Athreos deck, though. So that one is 1, a white, and a black for a legendary enchantment creature god. 5/4 indestructible. Devotion has to be 7 for him to do his thing. Whenever another creature you own dies, return it to your hand unless target opponent pays 3 life. Initially, when I was looking at this, and when a lot of people were looking at this, there was that concern of why would you give your opponents choices? They're always going to make the choice that is best for them and worse for you. But turns out when you build Athreos into a fairly strong, fairly resilient, like Orzhov Aristocrats type deck, there are no good choices left for your opponents to make eventually. Eventually, you're going to get someone to the point where they have to do what you want them to do.
And that's why I say in the 99, like, there are members of the gods here that, as heads of their own decks, can be incredibly strong. Athreos, for example, Kruphix, and Keranos to an extent. But the amount of times I've built decks, I'm just like, you know what? I rose to be solid here. Like, the deck ultimately wants to turn sideways, this would be great. And I rose is 4 mana, 2 generic, a red and a white, legendary enchantment creature god, indestructible, devotion 7. Creatures you control can't be blocked except by 2 or more creatures.
That's
Precursor. Precursor to menace. And then prevent all damage that would be dealt to attacking creatures you control. So
swing freely.
Exactly. And you would imagine decks that want to swing freely, it absolutely would be there. And it makes the rough draft for decks all the time that involves those two colors and attacking. And I can never seem to just sell it. And that's it. A lot of these gods remind me of the card from Return to Ravnica that we joke about all the time that seems like it should be good but never makes it into any decks. Jake, you probably remember it off the top of your head because you're the one that often
Priest
uses
of Forgotten Gods. Priest of Forgotten God.
Yeah, there's the one. It's like this could be so good. I need to cut one card. All right, there goes
well,
Priest of
the
Forgotten
Gods. Your activated
ability
is a tap. You're gone.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah, and a lot of these were kind of in that boat. Like, there was actually a Kruphix God of Horizons deck at one of the shops I went to back in New Jersey before I moved. That was a bit of a terror. So Kruphix is 3, a green, and a blue. The Simic God is a 4/7 with indestructible. Again, the devotion count has to be 7. You have no maximum hand size, and if unused mana would empty from your mana pool, instead that mana becomes colorless. So it allows you to just bank mana infinitely. And this was at the head of a lot of those green-blue ramp decks that we were seeing around this time, back when Prophet of Kruphix was still a legal thing, and people would just bank boatloads of mana, and on their turn, they'd untap with like 30 or 40 mana, and say, okay, I'm going to do this big dumb thing, an extra turn spell, and can anyone stop me? No? Okay. But I think as the metagame has kind of sped up and converted mana costs have gone down, that threat of being able to bank oodles of mana has also dropped off in prominence.
And it's funny, as that happens, more cards that have a banking like ability become more prominent. Because it was for a while that Kruphix was the only god that allowed you to do that, or only card that allowed you to do that for a while, and now they're exploring that territory again.
There was also a brief time where Keranos was a CEDH commander for a Staxy deck. Yeah, it was Blue Moon.
Yeah. So Keranos, God of Storms, is 3, a blue, and a red for a legendary enchantment creature god. It is a 6/5 with indestructible, yada yada yada, devotion 7. Reveal the first card you draw on each of your turns. Whenever you reveal a land card this way, draw a card. So a way to potentially double up your card draw. Whenever you reveal a non-land card this way, Keranos deals 3 damage to target creature or player. So the way this deck wound up working was really interesting. Once you got everyone locked down with Back to Basics, and Blood Moon, and Magus of the Moon, and all the ways to just deny your opponent's mana, Keranos would allow you to break parity by drawing additional cards, and if you didn't get an additional card, you still got to pick off an annoying Hate Bear or Mana Dork or some other value piece they were trying to rely on, or just start whittling down the black player's life total. It was fine. It did not revolutionize CEDH, but it was, for a time, a legitimate
deck. I think the main win condition for it was also Paradox Engine, which,
That's funny, the two gods we mentioned here, Kruphix and Keranos, are made popular and stronger by two cards that both got banned for roughly the same reasons, Paradox Engine and Prophet Kruphix.
So when we got to Amonkhet, we saw a fairly different take on gods. I think this is a little bit truer to the vision you had when you were talking about those Theros gods, Alex. So again, when we got to Amonkhet, the Egyptian mythology-inspired plane, we got 5 single-color gods, each corresponding to the 5 colors of magic. We got in white, Oketra the True. In blue, we got Kefnet the Mindful. In black, we got Bantu the Glorified. In red, we got Hazoret the Fervent. And in green, we got Ronas the Indomitable. So in my mind, these fit a little bit better what you described as the devotion you thought was more interesting, Alex.
So unlike the other gods on Theros, where they exist in Nyx and then come down when the plane fits their needs, these gods live amongst their followers. So on the fantasy aspect, they are as common. For those of you that have read the Magic Online story, our heroes encounter them. You know, they arrive on Amonkhet, they go into the main city, and then go, why is there a giant cat person walking down the street? And, oh, well, that's one of the gods of this realm. Their abilities also tie a bit closer to what they represent. Lore backstory, Amonkhet was a plane of just predominant trials to build the ultimate warriors that, spoilers, eventually become Nicol Bolas' zombies. And each of these gods represented something. You know, valor, aggression, glory, wisdom, strength, things of that nature throughout the cards and the color wheel. And each of these gods represents something like that. So if we look at Oketra, who is true, faith, camaraderie, things of that nature, she reads, and I feel like I'm taking this away from you, as you actually have an Oketra deck, John, so you actually tell us what Oketra...
Yeah, but not this Oketra. I have the good Oketra.
So Oketra is 4 mana, which seems to be the, you know, the running tally for, you know, god costs. Legendary creature god, not an enchantment. A double strike and indestructible. Oketra the True can't attack or block unless you control at least 3 other creatures. So right there, it fits into her themes of camaraderie, friendship, things of that nature. And to augment that, for 3 and a white, create a 1/1 white warrior creature token with vigilance. So on theme, she's the god of camaraderie and team. She can't attack unless there are 3 other creatures. She can make other warriors that, you know, fit that vigilance theme, and that thematically feels more godlike, you know, working in among the people, or in your case, machines.
I will say once again, though, it feels like Oketra the True is probably the weakest. Again, the mono white god is the weakest of the 5 gods we see in our initial visit to the plane.
Indeed.
But unlike the Theros gods, these gods did not make as big of an impact on Commander as a whole when they showed up in terms of inspiring a large new number of decks being brewed around them. Part of it, these are still indestructible creatures. They still have some meaty ability score, meaty stat lines with some not too hard requirements to meet to quote unquote turn them on. And they have useful activated abilities on them. But they did not see the same flurry of building that the Theros gods did.
That being said, in Standard, Hazoret was an absolute menace.
Oh yeah, Hazoret the Fervent. So 3 and a red for a 5/4 indestructible haste legendary creature god. Can't attack or block unless you have 1 or fewer cards in your hand, unless you are heck-bent. And then the activated ability, 2 and a red, discard a card. Hazoret deals 2 damage to each opponent. Yeah, there was a reason why mono-red was so darn good in the Standard environment at that time.
And then...
But did not make much of an impact on Commander, though.
But, you know, fun fact, there were, you know, 3 additional god siblings that existed on Amonkhet that mysteriously vanished from the plane.
Well, before... I'm gonna pause you there. Before we get to that, though, there actually was another one of the gods out of this cycle who made an impact, small one, on CDH. Kefnet the Mindful is 2 and a blue for a 5/5 legendary creature god with flying and indestructible, so great stat line. Kefnet the Mindful can't attack or block unless you have 7 or more cards in hand, and its activated ability reads, 3 and a blue, draw a card, then you may return a land you control to its owner's hand. So Kefnet the Mindful, there have been attempts to take advantage of its indestructibility with polymorph builds. The other version that saw some brewing around was the Mystic Sanctuary version. So a Kefnet Turns deck where you would use your mono blue mana base to keep playing Mystic Sanctuary. The non-basic island from Throne of Eldraine, you would be able to play it, get an extra turn spell back into your hand. Then you can use Kefnet's activated ability to return a land, Mystic Sanctuary, back to your hand and continue to play your extra turn spell over and over and eventually just beat everyone to death with a 5/5 flying god.
I'm not going to lie, when you said there's another one that made a small change, I honestly thought you were just going to say Ronas and, like, Savala Brostorm decks because it's just a 5-power creature for 3 mana.
I don't actually know if Ronas sees play in actually good Brostorm decks or just my Galta deck.
I was going to say, like, your Galta deck came to mind. I'm just like, I didn't realize any of these made splashes anywhere except
no,
for,
Kefnet,
hey,
yeah.
That makes a Savala tap for 5 relatively early, so that's a thing, maybe. Draw a card, tap for 5.
But as you were saying, Alex, there were some gods who made a much bigger splash in the General Commander metagame, and they came out in our next set, Hour of Devastation. And these are the Bolas Colored Gods.
And each and every one of these had a deck built around it at some point in time, because they are thematically interesting.
And very potentially powerful. And, Jake, you noticed something else about these, and something we've kind of, one of the themes that we wanted to hit upon as we were talking about this, about these gods. They're not indestructible.
Yep, so these are some of the first gods that don't have the indestructible line on them. They're also the first set of gods that don't have any kind of hoops you have to jump through in order for them to serve their purpose as a creature. They just come down and attack, block, whatever. Everything else either needs devotion or mechanically specific things for that particular color.
Now, of these three, I personally had the Locust God that John has played against in the past. It was a brief deck because it is expensive. Locust God is 6 mana for a blue and a red for a legendary creature god, flying. It looks like a horrendous monstrosity of the character Saru from Star Trek Discovery and a locust.
Nerd.
Flying. I don't know what that is.
It's fine. Just you see it and then put a locust face on it and then you'll understand. It's got really long arms. Whenever you draw a card, create a 1/1 blue and red insect creature token with flying and haste. So that sounds good. That sounds great in and of itself for, you know, colored combinations like to draw cards. But it has more. For 2, a red and a blue, draw a card, then discard a card. So it lets you loot. Granted, at a more expensive rate than traditional loot cards, you still get it. In this case, it happens to also get you a 1/1 hasty flyer. When the Locust God dies, return it to the owner's hand at the beginning of the next end step. So it doesn't have indestructible, but by no means does that mean it's going away easily.
Yeah, so number one, this was the first time we saw an alternate take on these indestructible gods. These gods could be stopped, at least temporarily, but they were also like zombie gods who just kept coming back. These gods served Bolas, and Bolas doesn't let anybody destroy his toys except for him. The Locust God also made for a really powerful deck, even if it cost a lot of mana to get to that 6 to get the Locust God out. But I've seen your Locust God deck, Alex. I've seen multiple Locust God decks. A lot of them are still fairly strong. Once you land the Locust God, if you can get it down and then start any type of cycle going where you have a draw off of creatures entering the battlefield or dealing damage, you can very quickly get swarmed.
Ba-dum-bum.
I'm not sorry.
I mean, there's actually a card called Swarm Intelligence that pretty much just augments this, so yeah
exactly.
Sure. It's one of the one of the first prominent wheel-focused commanders that kind of brought that playstyle into the limelight, I think.
I mean, Nekuzar probably a little bit beforehand, but I think that...
Yeah, but this one's, like, a little better.
I agree. Now, speaking of a little bit better, the Scarab God saw a lot of play around this time frame, too. He was a powerhouse in Standard. It's a pretty darn good commander. I've seen it used a lot as just a zombie commander card in general. So the Scarab God is 3, a blue, and a black for legendary creature god. It is a 5/5. At the beginning of your upkeep, each opponent loses X life and you scry X, where X is equal to the number of zombies you control. You can pay 2, a blue, and a black to exile target creature card, and then you create a token that is a copy of it, except it's a 4/4 black zombie. So this was a really powerful way in Standard to deny your opponent resources and get big beaters. It was really powerful in Commander to just make probably cheaper copies of the crazy big stuff your opponents were doing, or take your own dinky stuff or their dinky stuff and make it bigger and relevant.
It's nice because it's either zombie tribal or reanimation or just blue-black value. It's pretty flexible.
Hey, Jake, you know what it doesn't do?
Mill.
Yeah. Yep. And I think among the Hour of Devastation gods who didn't really get there as much, the Scorpion God was probably the least built among the three of them. I haven't actually run the numbers, but the Scorpion God is 3, a black, and a red for a 6/5 legendary creature god. Whenever a creature with a -1/-1 counter on it dies, draw a card. Activated ability, 1, a black, and a red, put a -1/-1 counter on another target creature. And then that zombie clause, whenever the Scorpion God dies, return it to its owner's hand at the beginning of the next end step.
I think the biggest strike against this one is just the color identity.
Yeah.
Yeah, like if this were green instead of red, it would be fantastic.
Yes, I distinctly remember like, okay, how can I get this and Hapatra in the same deck? And there was no really good place to put it. This is the one I think I've seen the least of. I think I've actually only ever seen this in the wild once.
Which is funny, because in the lore, the Scorpion God is the one that actually was the big beater. It's the scariest, most prominent of the three.
Yes, R.I.P. Ronas.
But not for long.
All right, guys, we're running a little bit long. Next time, why don't we pick up with whatever could have happened when a bunch of horrible zombie gods invaded Amonkhet, and what would have befallen our beloved monocolored gods from Amonkhet? What gods lie beyond Amonkhet? What happens when we go back to Theros? And what awaits for us in Kaldheim?
I want to say gods. I want to say gods. Gods
awaits. We'll probably have some more spoilers by then, too. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, so join us again in a few weeks. We're going to pick up from here with all the rest of the gods in the history of magic. Until then, I'm John.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Jake.
You can reach the crew from Gemstone Mine on Twitter at GemstoneMineMTG or send us an email at GemstoneMinePodcast@gmail.com. On YouTube, we're Gemstone Mine Podcast. Be sure to like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell.